Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Night of the Living Dead from 1990. I've already covered the original Night of the Living Dead on this podcast, and if you remember that episode, you'll remember that one of the very things that made Romero's landmark movie famous is the same thing that prevented him from seeing the lion's share of the profits the film made over the years. Night was printed without a copyright notice, immediately placing it into the public domain. Although Romero and his collaborators at Image 10 fought hard in the courts, and although his case did bring about some reforms to the copyright laws that were badly needed, it was nonetheless true that by the 1980s, virtually every film and video distributor had some version of Night of the Living Dead in their catalog, and Romero wasn't seeing a dime from any of them. To make things worse, the movie's public domain status meant that anyone could remake it, and famous schlock producer Menahem Golan was beginning to develop a project for his new company 21st Century Film. He'd recently been forced out of his old company, Canon Films, which I discussed briefly in my episode on the movie Life Force. Suffice to say that a full history of Golan, his cousin Yoram Globus, and their studio would take a lot more space than I have here, and in fact there are two whole documentaries on the subject out there. So if you want to know more about the most famous hucksters in Hollywood, you can watch Electric Boogaloo, or The Go-Go Boys, or listen to the podcast I Saw It on Linden Street, which had a great series on Canon and its highlights. Realizing they could wind up cut out of the profits of a second movie based on their work, Romero, original screenwriter John Russo, and producer Russell Striner decided to settle their differences. The breakup of the Image 10 film collective was a painful one, with everyone involved blaming each other for the inability to produce a successful follow-up to Night, and get on board with Golan's vision. Golan, in turn, acknowledged that an authorized remake with the original creators would probably sell better than a ripoff, and decided to bring them in for his version of the classic film. Not wanting to direct the same movie twice, Romero initially approached Peter Hyams before persuading Tom Savini, who'd been hired to do the special effects, to step into the director's chair. He'd done a few episodes of Tales from the Dark Side, a syndicated horror anthology series produced by Romero, but this was his first feature, and brother, could it not have come at a worse time. We've talked in the past about how Savini spent most of the 80s riding high as an undisputed master of special effects, but this was a rough patch for him. He was going through a messy divorce, and his initial storyboards were extremely ambitious for a first-time feature director. Romero wasn't on the set very often after he turned in the revised screenplay, and Golan clashed with Savini over both the shooting schedule, which Romero said would take 6 weeks to shoot despite Savini's insistence that he could do it in four, and the movie's violence, which Golan feared would earn the film an X rating. That wouldn't have been out of keeping with the original, which was famously released before the introduction of the rating system, or its two sequels, which were both released unrated, but times had changed and it was hard to make money on a movie that couldn't be released through the big corporate cinema chains. With Savini now tied down to the director's chair, John Vulick was brought in for the makeup effects. Vulick had worked with Savini on both Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter, and Day of the Dead, and Savini trusted him to handle the elaborate zombie effects required for the film. Wanting to avoid the kind of over-the-top gore he'd become known for after Day of the Dead, Savini instructed Vulick to go as realistic as possible using autopsy footage, and more controversially, concentration camp photos, as a guideline to create zombies that looked like they'd authentically gotten back up just minutes after death. For the vitally important lead role of Barbara, whose part had been substantially rewritten and upgraded for the 1990 version of the story, Savini turned to his good friend, stunt performer and actor Patricia Tallman. Tallman hadn't done a lot of acting before this film. She's honestly best known for her turn on Babylon 5, which wouldn't come for another few years yet, but she'd already done some stunt work for Romero and Savini in Creepshow 2, Tales from the Dark Side, and Monkey Shines, and Savini knew she could handle the job. Stepping into the very big shoes Dwayne Jones left as Ben, unfortunately Jones died of a heart attack 2 years before this movie was released, is genre icon Tony Todd. To modern audiences, it seems obvious to cast Todd here. He's legendary for his horror roles, from the Candyman films to the Final Destination series to the Hatchet movies, and a metric ton of other TV and movie appearances in between. including the animated remake of this film, Night of the Living Dead, Darkest Dawn, where he reprised his role as Ben opposite Joseph Pilato from Day of the Dead as Harry Cooper. But all that was in his future when he beat out both Ving Rhames and Lawrence Fishburne for this part. Back in 1990, he was a guest performer and dramatic character actor whose biggest parts were in Lean on Me and Platoon. This was very much the beginning of his horror style era, and we are here for it. And speaking of horror and style, Tom Towles, who plays Harry Cooper, already had a massively high-profile horror role under his belt when he took this part, as Otis in the infamous Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. He didn't do a ton of horror after this, settling in as a character actor and day player on TV shows from Seinfeld to Malcolm in the Middle, but he was in both House of a Thousand Corpses and The Devil's Rejects for Rob Zombie, and apparently the director liked him enough to give him cameos in both his fake Grindhouse trailer and in the 2007 Halloween remake. According to Todd, the tension between the two men was real and unfeigned during filming, but they made amends later on before Towles' death in 2015. Harry's wife Helen is played by McKee Anderson, who didn't do a lot of acting for film or television. Apart from this, her credits mostly include guest roles on early 80s TV shows, but who's done a lot of acting on stage, screen, and in prison, according to her IMDb biography. I don't mean in the Zero Mostel at the end of the producer's sense, mind you. Apparently, she spent a lot of her career doing workshops at correctional facilities, both with the officers and with the inmates, in order to give the prisoners a creative outlet and the officers a chance to roleplay out potentially hazardous scenarios to learn how to de-escalate them. She's also been working on a documentary about her mother's struggle with Alzheimer's, although I don't seem to be able to find any release information about it, and it may not have found a distributor. William Butler, who here plays Tom, had already found something of a home in horror even before this movie. He was in Ghoulies 2, Friday the 13th Part 7, Arena, Freddy's Nightmares, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3 all by the time this film was released. But he really hit his stride when he went on to write and direct horror. In 2022 alone, he made the films Beyond the Resonator, Curse of the Reanimator, Baby Oopsie 2, Murder Dolls, and Baby Oopsie 3, Burn Baby Burn, as well as the short The 12 Slays of Christmas, I will give you exactly one guess as to how Slays is spelled, and the TV miniseries The Resonator and Baby Oopsie The Series. Certainly a hard worker, even if I suspect they're the kind of films you have a certain kind of trashy taste, like me, to fully appreciate. Acting as the Judy to Butler's Tom is Katie Finneran, although here she's Judy Rose, said all as one word multiple times over the course of the movie in a variety of anguished tones. Finneran is a character actor and day player who's been in a number of productions from You've Got Mail to Wonderfalls to The Inside to The Michael J. Fox Show. Most recently, she's been in Up Here for Hulu and Secret Invasion for Disney+, and I cannot stress enough how impressed I am that someone can have a career in Hollywood from 1990 all the way up to 2023 while still having to hustle for every single role. That's some amazing talent and hard work, and she deserves some props for it. And speaking of hard-working character actors, this movie's Johnny is played by Bill Moseley, one of the true genre kings. He got his big break playing Chop Top in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, and the moment he realized he could play big, wild, over-the-top genre roles and people would love him for it, he never looked back. We talked about him in Army of Darkness, where he voiced the Deadite Captain, but he was also in House of a Thousand Corpses, The Devil's Rejects, Repo the Genetic Opera, Night of the Living Dead Darkest Dawn, where he reprises his role as Johnny, Three from Hell, Shed of the Dead, Big Top Evil, and Hayride to Hell, among many others. Even now, he's got 9 movies in the pipeline, from Scared to Death to Frankenstein Gothic to Night of the Missing, and you just gotta admire a man who's doing what he loves. And last but not least, playing Sarah Cooper, changed from Karen this time out, it seems like a trend for some reason in remakes of this movie, although this was long before that name became synonymous with a very specific type of white woman, we have Heather Mazur in her acting debut. And like Finneran, she's worked steadily over the years, popping up in movies like Darkness Rising and 911 Nightmare, and guest starring on TV shows like Castle and NCIS, and doing longer stints on soap operas like General Hospital. And again, that's not an easy way to make a living, and she should be commended for her hard work. We won't see Sarah for a while yet, as this film opens much like the original. After the opening credits, which play out over a shot of an ominously rising moon, we cut to Barbara and Johnny making their fateful drive out to the distant cemetery. This time they're going out to visit their mother's grave, but as with the original, they spend a lot of the time bickering over Johnny's irritation with the long drive and the familial obligation to see a mother he wasn't close to even when he was alive. There are some very tiny hints that their family life might have been an abusive one, which Savini added to build up to an emotional payoff where Barbara hallucinates one of the zombies to be her deceased mother, but that was cut during shooting to save time. This is, not to put too fine a point on it, going to be a common refrain over the course of this movie. Savini also wanted this opening sequence to be black and white, gradually fading into color as they drove to the cemetery, and I think I'm glad he was overruled because the remake already has a very muted palette in most of its indoor scenes, and the exterior shots of the cemetery are some of the few genuinely striking pops of color in the whole film. He also made the odd choice to have the dialogue fade out whenever the car gets further away from the static camera as we cut from one stage of their journey to the next, and I wish someone would have overruled him there because without subtitles, a lot of this opening exposition is literally impossible to hear. As with the original, they get out and Johnny begins teasing her about her fear of the cemetery, but in this version Mosley takes the gag a lot further and goes way more over the top, going so far as to pretend to be dragged down into the grave by his mother. It's honestly such a broad performance that I had to take a moment to look up Jim Carrey and see whether he'd already gotten his big break on In Living Color by the time this movie was being filmed. He hadn't, but this does kind of feel like if you had asked Bill Mosley to play Johnny from Night of the Living Dead like Jim Carrey would do it, he'd wind up looking a lot like this. None of which is to fault Mosley. After Chop Top, this is exactly the kind of acting people hired him for, and clearly it was what Savini wanted, even if it doesn't quite work for me. We briefly see the grave, and again it even has a picture of the departed mother to help us fix her in our memory for a payoff that never arrives, before someone comes staggering up to them. But this time it's not a zombie, but a mourner who's dazed and confused after a head injury, he's played by Pat Rees, and he goes lurching off, stammering apologies to the duo, which cleverly draws the viewer's attention away from Johnny, just in time for the actual cemetery ghoul to come lurching in from off-screen at him in a potent jump scare. That's going to be a theme of this version of Night. The movie expects you to be familiar with its famous predecessor, and a lot of its scares involve letting you think you're in for one thing when it actually hits you with something else. Which makes it all the more frustrating that a lot of reviewers knocked it as simply being a retread of the original. I think there are legitimate criticisms to make about the movie, but that's not one of them. Savini's very clearly trying to do something different, and I don't think that was noticed much in 1990. Johnny winds up getting into a struggle with the ghoul, played in this movie by Greg Funk, that ends as the original with him falling face first onto a tombstone. Savini wanted to show more of the moments that Romero's limited budget only allowed him to imply, so we do see the tombstone fall, but I have to say that I think Romero might have been the wiser one. The dummy that hits the grave is so obviously fake that it doesn't look like they were even trying to make it resemble Bill Mosley. It looks more like one of those old Risasa Annie dolls they use for CPR practice dressed in a wig in his costume. It doesn't even bend like a real person at the waist, and I'm honestly surprised someone didn't cut it in editing because it is the sort of thing that produces unintentional laughter. Johnny is of course dead, and Barbara stabs the ghoul uselessly with the grave decoration they brought before running back to the car. She's momentarily grateful to see what appears to be another mourner, played by Tim Carrier, but as he steps on his own cuffs and his clothes slide down to reveal autopsy scars, we realize his lifelike appearance is due to embalming and he's another one of the walking dead. Barbara locks herself in the car, but the cemetery ghoul once again lurches into frame behind her and she realizes she's surrounded without keys or even shoes. The undead batter their way in, breaking the window with a brick as in the original, and Barbara's forced to put the car in neutral and coast down the hill to get away. She crashes the car just like before, and this time Savini's able to really give us the production value the classic version couldn't by making it a good hard smack straight into the back of a tree that caves in the rear bumper in a nice bit of spectacle. This was Savini's actual car, sold to the production and used for the stunt. He apparently felt bad about having to say goodbye to it. Barbara gets out and runs through the woods, and this is why you get a professional stunt performer for this scene. Tallman does a good job of slipping and sliding on the uneven ground and eats dirt on at least a couple of occasions to make her flight look genuinely panicked. Again, though, I have to mention the odd choice of muted colors. She's wearing a shirt that's almost beige, and a brown and white checked skirt that makes her look very bland and boring as a character. I have to imagine that this was some sort of intentional evocation of the old black and white look, but it does undercut some of what they're trying to do with giving her character more action and agency, even though she does change clothes as the film progresses. Thank goodness Tallman's bright red hair can't be obscured or subdued under any circumstances. Barbara finds first a barn, then an old farmhouse, and if it suddenly sounds like she's wearing shoes as she walks up the gravel driveway, that's because Savini conscientiously decided to shoot this part from waist height so she could slip something on and wouldn't have to cross the sharp gravel on her bare feet. I'm glad to hear stories like this, even if it involves sacrificing an insignificant increment of realism, because most people won't notice and Tallman doesn't deserve to get her feet bloodied for a movie role. We've heard a lot of directors demand horrible things from their actors for authenticity's sake, and it's good to hear that Savini doesn't play that game in this film. The farmhouse has a plaque on the wall saying M. Celeste, which is intended as a reference to the abandoned sailing ship, the Mary Celeste, from 1872. This ship was found derelict, with its lifeboat missing and its entire crew absent, and no explanation was ever found for their sudden departure or their ultimate fate. The log contained no entry detailing their decision to abandon the vessel, and their possessions were still on board. Some speculate there was an accident involving the cargo of flammable alcohol that spooked them into fleeing, but this still leaves a ton of unanswered and unanswerable questions to this very day. All of which doesn't really apply here, as we find out from Tom exactly who owned this house and exactly what happened to them before Barbara arrived, but it's still a nice touch. The front door is locked, but Barbara finds her way in through the back into the kitchen. She turns off the stove, which is still on and burning food in a pan, and begins looking for help. She instead finds blood dripping from the staircase leading to the upper floor and a hand slowly moving toward the banisters, but it turns out that it's a severed hand being nudged forward by a heavyset zombie as he stumbles toward the new arrival. It lands on Barbara's head, and again, I feel like someone should have talked to Savini or Vulik about this, because it obviously jiggles and wiggles like something made out of gelatin. And soon afterward, the zombie himself, we'll find out later this is Uncle Reege, played by stunt performer Pat Logan, comes crashing through the railing and nearly lands on top of Barbara as well before she rolls away in the nick of time. Savini was originally going to shoot this fall over the zombie's shoulder, with Tallman's back up against a carpeted wall and Logan dollied directly at her, but Golan claimed it would be too elaborate and time-consuming. There's a book called Night of the Living Dead 90, The Version You've Never Seen, which goes through Savini's storyboards one by one and explains why they diverge from the finished film. If you like this movie, it's worth tracking down. The zombie gets back up, and Barbara runs for the back door, only to find another zombie entering the house, played by John Hamilton. She slips past Uncle Reege and out the front door, only to see yet a third zombie stumbling up the gravel driveway, this one played by Dirk Ashton. But luckily for her, a truck is coming, and its driver mows the zombie down in a stunt I have to admit is pretty damn spectacular. Ben gets out, and like in the original, Barbara's a little too shell-shocked to give him useful information right away. But this version of Ben isn't quite as patient with her, giving her a good hard shake and telling her to snap the hell out of it before dragging her inside. I like that Tony Todd's Ben is a little bit more urgent and a little bit less composed than Dwayne Jones in the original. I feel like that's a nice touch of realism that sets him apart from the original version very well. Ben uses the frying pan to knock down the zombie in the kitchen before impaling it through the skull with a crowbar he brought inside, and Barbara grabs a poker from the fireplace to beat Uncle Reege back to his second death with it. Or, at least, to beat a very obvious dummy with it. I don't want to be overly critical, but there are quite a few FX and makeup shots in this movie that really aren't up to Savini's usual standards for realism, and I'm kind of surprised he and Vulik didn't have more of a conversation about it. Then again, maybe they did and they just kept it private. There are always reasons why a film's production values look cheap, usually because they don't have the money to make them look expensive, and I suspect Savini knew all about whatever challenges his friend was facing here. With the immediate threats gone, Ben tries to get through to Barbara again, and this time she's a little more lucid. She's still on the verge of tears, but she's able to nod and shake her head when he asks her questions. They take out another zombie who's made it up to the front porch, played by Jordan Berlant, falling into frame in another impressive jump scare, and Ben goes down to the driveway to put the zombie he hit with the car out of its misery. Ben gives out an anguished, "God damn you! God damn all of you!" to the sky as he slumps down over the re-killed corpse and makes the sign of the cross. It's a tiny bit camp, but let's face it, Tony Todd can sell anything. The version Savini had planned, though, where the camera would zoom into the darkness in Ben's mouth as he screamed and zoom back out with night having fallen, would have been so much campier that I think it might have tipped the movie over into comedy, at least for a few moments. I do love the nice touch of dusting the zombies down with a tiny bit of baby powder for these fight scenes, by the way. It really gives a sense of visceral impact to the on-camera hits. Which is good, because the crowbar is very obviously made of rubber and you can see it bend every time it smacks into Berlant's face. The budget on this movie was $4.2 million, the equivalent of about $9.8 million now, which is not a lot of money for an effects-laden film, even though they would have saved quite a bit of money by using unknown actors in a single location. Plus, there's one sequence that's going to eat up a pretty big chunk of the available cash, but we'll get to it. The two go back inside as the sun begins to set, and I have to say, for all that Savini complains in his book about having to shoot so much of the film in daylight, I really like the way this movie looks when the sun is still out. Somehow it really adds to the desolation, the sense that they're genuinely abandoned, and even though they can see the zombies coming, it doesn't really help. It all looks creepy and gorgeous at the same time. Ben tells Barbara that the truck is almost out of gas, and shares his story of the carnage he saw out in the city as night finally falls. Honestly, the scariest thing in this sequence is the absence of any barricading. In the original movie, Ben immediately got straight to boarding the windows and barring the doors, but in this version, he just chats with Barbara, leaving the audience to stare anxiously at every open space in the background. It's surprisingly effective. Barbara uses the opportunity to roll Uncle Reg up in the rug, dragging him around with the poker so she doesn't have to touch him directly. They toss the corpses out the back door to an oddly jazzy tune that feels very out of keeping with the tone of the scene. The music for this film is by Paul McCullough, a colleague of Russo's. And then Ben shares this film's version of the Beekman's Diner speech as Barbara puts on some heavy boots and several pairs of socks to help them fit. Ben makes two things eminently clear in this scene. First, that the creatures are dead and still walking, and second, that they can only be put down by destroying their brains, which makes a later moment a tiny bit of a repeated beat, but again, this is Tony Todd in full form, so who cares? The phone is dead, and for some reason, despite this being a contemporary film set in 1989, Uncle Reg doesn't have a TV in the living room. Honestly, that was a stretch even in the 1968 version, but 20 years later, television would have become so ubiquitous that even poor families would have been able to afford at least a black and white set for any frequently used room in the house. But there's ammo, and that means there's guns, so Ben goes looking for the weapons he knows the former owner had. He does find a rifle, along with a man who died by suicide after having his left hand gnawed clean off at the wrist, and apparently turned to gelatin, although the appearance of this corpse is a genuine triumph of makeup from Vulek, and Savini's smart to let the camera linger uncomfortably on it. While Ben's upstairs, Harry and Tom emerge from the cellar, and Ben races back to hold them at gunpoint. Ben and Harry take an instant dislike to each other, and one of the things I like about this version is that it's not as clear and simple as it was in the original. Sure, Harry's abrasive and rude, and as with Mosley, I'm not sure I'm 100% on board with some of the performance choices Towles makes here, in particular the Jersey Goomba accent and the odd insults like lame brain and yo-yo to describe Ben and the others, but in this version, Ben is immediately just as antagonistic right back to him. He shares some culpability for the tension in the house, and I think that's a much more interesting story than, "God, Harry, will you shut the fuck up every single time?" Savini did want to make this a little more clear-cut by having Harry be an overt racist who threw around slurs, but he was overruled, and I think wisely so. Tom shares some of the details of what happened in the house before Ben and the others came. The big zombie was Tom's uncle Reege, and he attacked Tom's cousin Satchel when Tom and Judy Rose came over to check on them at the start of all the trouble. Which does make you wonder what Barbara and Johnny were listening to on the radio if they didn't know about any of this when they got to the cemetery. I can't imagine they'd have turned it off so they could really get into a deep conversation with each other, you know? Harry, Helen, and their kid Sarah showed up after Satchel died, and the five of them barricaded themselves into the cellar to stay safe. Harry does a little interrogating of his own, finding out that Ben has a truck that's almost out of gas, and he suggests trying for the nearest city on whatever they have left until Ben points out just how dangerous it would be to run dry in the middle of a zombie-infested Evans City. Population 1708 as of 2021, which is pretty tiny, but not when you think of it in terms of every single one of them trying to murder you. Tom mentions that there is a gas pump on the property, but that it's locked and he doesn't know where the keys are. Harry suggests taking the whole conversation to the cellar, but Ben doesn't want to lock himself into a space with only one way in and out without finding out what all the options are. He tells Harry to go down to the cellar on his own because the two of them clearly have clashing personalities, but Harry doesn't take the hint and he's the first to insist that Reege couldn't have been dead because dead people don't get up and move around. So we've got that to deal with later on. Barbara spots some more zombies coming and we get much the same beats as in the original. Ben calls the cellar a death trap, he tells Harry he can be the boss downstairs, and Tom and Judy come up to join the barricading party. There's a moment of what I believe to be intentional comedy around here when Tom explains that he didn't put down Uncle Reege because he couldn't imagine killing someone like that, while Barbara gets the most hilariously awkward expression on her face. But this time the barricading feels a lot more urgent and tense, mainly because they didn't do any of it earlier. They've left themselves a ton of work to do and very little time to do it as the zombies begin to close in on the house. And I will say they give Towles one very effective line as he stares at the group and all of his posturing drops away as he says very simply, "You're gonna die up here." Down in the cellar, the Coopers have their traditional argument, and the weird jerseyness of the couple makes this feel like the strangest fucking deleted scene from The Sopranos. Anderson is dressed like a mobster's trophy wife, and Towles gives his character an explosive temper that makes Carl Hardman seem sober and reasonable by comparison. There's even some physical spousal abuse in this scene, just to warn you. It's a scene that plays a little too broad and ham-fisted for my taste, which is a shame because everything that's going on upstairs feels exciting and dangerous and filled with energy. Barbara observes the approaching zombies and suggests their best course of action might be to just leave the house that's rapidly attracting more and more of the living dead and simply walk somewhere safe. The zombies are slow, stupid, and weak, easy to evade and easy to kill. But Ben doesn't want to do anything precipitous, not when that bell can't be unrung once they go out on their own, and continues with the barricading. Well, Judy Rose gets in all of the screaming Barbara doesn't do in this version. She's kind of an underwritten character. Then again, Judy wasn't even in the screenplay of the 1968 version. She was added during shooting because everybody liked Judy Ridley's audition for Barbara and they wanted her to have a part. Ben and Tom go upstairs for more supplies, with Ben doing the nice thing and covering Cousin Satchel with a sheet first, and although they don't find much beyond a few planks of lumber, Uncle Reege was in the middle of putting newer, prettier, flimsier doors on all the halls and closets, they find a TV set up there with an emergency broadcast message. And speaking of TV-related things that are hard to swallow, this was 1989, a full decade after CNN first went on the air, and well into the era of round-the-clock crisis news coverage. Someone stuck in a rural area like Uncle Reege would have probably had a satellite dish, believe me, I saw plenty of them up north at the resort, and even if they didn't, the big three news networks would be covering every second of this story. You would not simply see a placard saying, in essence, "Stay tuned." It's one of the few big flaws of the movie, they don't really update any of the culture or technology stuff to the present day. Ben and Tom leave the TV upstairs, a significant change from the original, and Tom remembers that the doors Uncle Reege took off are all stored down in the cellar. Ben forces Harry to let them in by threatening to break the door down, which only intensifies the animosity between the two men, and they grab the extra lumber and use it to bolster their barricade. If I haven't mentioned Sarah here, it's because she's much less of a presence than in the original. In the first movie, she feels like a ticking time bomb, doomed to die and reanimate at any second, but in this version, she's almost an afterthought until the big finale. Ben and Harry argue until Judy Rose gets her big moment, pointing out that this house doesn't belong to either one of them, and they are guests on her and Tom's sufferance, which breaks up the fight and allows the fortifying to continue. Barbara takes a moment to change into pants, continuing her Sigourney Weaver Pokemon evolution. I'm saying it as a joke, but Savini cited Ripley as a major influence here. And when Helen finds out that there's a truck, a gas pump, and a way to get her daughter help if only they can find the key, she decides to turn the place upside down looking for it. Unfortunately, it's about here that time runs out for the fortification. One of the undead locals, Mr. Magruder, played by Walter Berry, comes crashing through a window before Ben can nail a door over it, and he's forced to simply try to push the zombie back to get it out of the house. Another zombie pushes back on the door Tom's holding, and Harry decides it's cellar time again, only now his wife is upstairs and won't listen to him when he tells her to go into the basement. He's forced to very reluctantly help Tom nail shut his door, and Barbara blows open the back of the other zombie's head. "You shot Mr. Magruder!" Judy Rose screams, horrified, but Barbara points to a second bullet hole in his back that she didn't cause to prove her point. These aren't living people. Not anymore. Judy and Harry both scoff at that, so when the next zombie pops up at the window, this one played by Charles Crawley, Barbara makes sure to put 3 bullets into his chest before she kills him to demonstrate her point. "Is he dead?" she shouts after every shot, forcing the skeptics to confront the reality of what's happening, and even though this is information that the audience and easily half the cast already knows by now, Pat Tallman gives it such a magnificent dramatic pitch that it's one of the genuine highlights of the movie. There are 2 alternate versions of this scene, by the way. The first, as storyboarded, is the payoff of the whole thread from the beginning. Barbara was going to see a female zombie who resembled her mom and have a vivid hallucination of her mother asking where Johnny was before she snapped out of it and killed her. The second, which was filmed, used a female zombie but no hallucination, but that was scrapped because of an on-set accident involving a misplaced squib that gave the actor a concussion when it went off. Legal nicks using any footage that contained the real accident, so it was reshot with Crawley, and I think we did get the best take on the material here. The zombies all politely hold off long enough for Barbara to scold Ben and Harry for losing their cool, and Tom boards up the broken window. Barbara then reloads the gun, now established as the coolest head in the entire group, and helps everyone finish the fortifications. But Harry hears the TV upstairs, now showing a live broadcast, and goes up to get it. He sneaks it back down and makes it all the way to the cellar door, yes, Donnie Darko, we know, before Ben spots him with it. The two of them struggle over it, and the set goes bouncing down the stairs and shatters into pieces as they both lose their grip on the precious source of information about the crisis outside. "We worked so hard and now it's all gone. We ended up with nothing because the 3 of us can't share." "What's your point?" "Nothing. Just kind of ticks me off." That's not what they said, obviously. That's a Simpsons quote. But it does feel that ham-fisted and forced of a moral lesson here. Well, Ben and Harry have a brief, ineffectual fistfight over the TV set, and Harry insists that he wasn't going to bring it all the way downstairs because you can't get TV reception in the basement, which you could in 1989. Lots of people did, and this is again a weirdly 1968 view of television technology. Barbara gets the bright idea to check Uncle Regis' corpse for the gas pump keys. They do find a set of keys, albeit an unlabeled one, and that's enough for the desperate group. They decide to drive on over to the pump and get some gas. Although again, Barbara suggests just leaving on foot to get help and letting the others barricade themselves in until they return. Ben makes a torch to frighten the zombies. This is one minor nitpick I have with the remake. They don't do anything before this point to establish that the zombies are actually afraid of fire, and he goes outside with Tom and Judy to refuel, with Judy driving and Tom riding shotgun with the, shotgun. Ben clambers into the truck bed with the torch after a few moments of tension as it looks like the vehicle won't start, and they head to the pumps for what we know is going to be a doomed effort. But I will say, this one is staged much more impressively than the original in every way. Ben gets thrown clear of the truck as it speeds towards the pump, leaving the torch in the truck bed as he struggles to catch up. Tom tries the keys, only to realize that none of them work. With the undead closing in and very few options available to him, he tries to shoot the lock off, but in this version he hits the hose instead and gas sprays all over the truck and truck bed. Within a matter of seconds, the gasoline is ignited by the torch, and the whole thing, pumps, truck, and all go up in a fireball that Don Coscarelli would have been immensely proud of. It's a magnificent sequence, paced perfectly and utterly thrilling, and one of the places where this film genuinely improves on its namesake. I know it's not the version Savini wanted. He was going to have Tom accidentally ignited by the torch and set the gas on fire with his own burning body, but I think it's beautiful here. A real jaw-dropper. Harry sends Helen down to the cellar before trying to get the gun away from Barbara, but Sarah's already turned and the decision is basically Helen's death warrant. It's just a bite this time, not the gnarly trowel stab we got in 68, but blood does splatter onto the trowel as an homage to the original. Savini had something a lot more elaborate planned here. Helen was going to find Sarah dying, not already turned and missing, and she was going to try to give Sarah mouth-to-mouth, only to have it go very, very badly for her as Sarah transformed mid-breath and bit her mother's lips off. But that was cut, presumably to try to keep that R rating, as was their subsequent battle where Helen grabbed the trowel to use it on her daughter, but fatally hesitated just a bit too long. It's a shame, even though what we get isn't exactly bad, and Heather Mazur has a wonderfully expressive mouth for lunging wide and biting down. From here, things go downhill pretty fast. A zombie knocks out the power as Barbara and Harry struggle over the gun, but even though he gets a hold of it, by that point there are zombies at the window and it's out of ammo by the time he fires even a few shots at them. Ben breaks back in as Harry's reloading, and he and Barbara take a pair of pistols off an undead police officer. Harry heads for the cellar, but stops dead in his tracks, no pun intended, when he sees his zombie daughter heading straight for him. Ben tries to shoot Sarah. Harry shoots Ben. Barbara shoots Sarah. Harry tries to shoot Barbara. Ben shoots Harry. Harry shoots Ben back. Ben shoots Harry again. And just like that, Barbara is apparently the only survivor, and I would love to see this entire sequence scored to whatcha say, because it does feel a lot like that Dear Sister sketch from Saturday Night Live. Even though Harry escapes into the attic and Ben escapes into the cellar, both men are wounded and need medical treatment. It doesn't look like they'll last long without help. And so, as predicted, Barbara just walks out of the house and straight past all the zombies. She spots a gang of undead feeding on Tom and Judy Rose in a scene that doesn't really hit anywhere near as hard as the 68 one did. Nothing against Savini, but Romero really had a knack for finding extras who would go all in on eating genuine entrails, and this just doesn't have that same verve. She catches up with a posse of zombie hunters, led by Hondo and Bulldog, played by David W. Butler and Zachary Mott, respectively, who have already killed her brother Johnny and thrown his corpse into the back of their truck. Originally, Savini wanted a final confrontation between the two, but Golan claimed there wasn't time to shoot it. While back at the house, Ben kills the undead Helen and slumps into a chair to listen to the emergency radio giving him advice he can no longer use, and giving us an exact date for the movie, August 23rd, 1989. He has a final cigarette, and the lighter illuminates a key to the gas pump hanging on the wall that sends him into a last bout of wild, broken laughter as the night comes to a close. The next morning, Barbara recovers with the posse, which has now joined up with the state police. The interview with Sheriff McClelland is recapitulated, with Bill Cardale reprising his role as the reporter and Russell Striner appearing as McClelland himself, and she watches as the group lynches a collection of zombies and uses them for target practice. This was apparently an homage to a scene planned for the original movie but never used, as lynchings were a much more fraught and immediate subject in 1968. They're us and we're them, she says to herself, commenting on the casual cruelty of the humans in a moment that's perhaps a little too on the nose, even for a series of films that prides itself on its social commentary. She leads the posse back to the farmhouse, and of course Ben comes out of the cellar as in the previous version, but this time he's already dead, because any ending where he was still alive and got shot by the cops would only have felt like a pale imitation of the original. But he does seem to recognize Barbara in the moments before he dies, which is an interestingly heartbreaking touch that foreshadows the direction Romero would take the franchise 15 years later. Barbara then separates from the others and finds Harry coming down the stairs, still alive and relieved beyond measure to see someone he recognizes. But Barbara's growing accustomed to this awful new world and its awful new rules. She shoots him in the head, and as the rest of the posse comes in to see what the noise is about, she coldly says, "There's another one for the fire." It's the same line that ends the original, but it's repurposed here to beautiful and chilling effect. Barbara is a survivor now, and if she's lost everything else in that single horrible night, she's not going to lose that. We get a series of still photos to close out the credits, but none of them are as horrifying as Barbara's dark, staring eyes. And I'd love to end it there, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Savini's planned version of this scene. Barbara was going to go up to the attic rather than Harry coming down, and he was going to try to hide from her behind a mirror only to have her shatter it with gunfire, forcing her to confront the crazed and broken image of her old self. I understand what he was going for, but I like a version where Barbara's perhaps a little less introspective about the changes she's undergoing. She's obviously messed up by all this, but it's not melodramatic or over the top, and I think that works for Pat Tallman's performance at the end. Honestly, of all the Romero Dead movies I want to see a direct sequel to, this is probably right up there at the top of the list with a Bub movie to follow Day. Tallman is such an amazing performer that I'd love to see what she'd do with this role 35 years or so later. And will I hang on to this movie? Yes, I think so. I like the fact that it takes its own direction and really develops Barbara, and even though I would say I like the original a touch more, comparison is always the thief of joy, and the wonderful thing about movies is that you don't have to pick between them. I can have both this and the 68 Night on my shelf and enjoy them both, depending on my mood. And isn't that half the fun of being a movie fan? And if you want to talk about Pat Tallman, Tony Todd, or anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as Half Price Horror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror... Okay, I know. We've been on a huge zombie kick lately. Between the Deadites, the Spanish Undead, and Romero's Shamblers, we have seen a lot of walking corpses around here in the past few months. But Boomer, my buddy from Podcast in the Woods, specifically requested one zombie movie in particular, and it's a weird and different enough take on the whole genre that I figured we could dip into it before we went off in a different direction for a while. So let's take on one of the strangest zombie movies of the aughts, 2008's Musing on Language and Semiotics, Pontypool. See you then.